Hello and welcome to the Friday edition of Catholic Answers Live. We try to have a little bit of fun on Friday. We try to do stuff that's kind of cool. And we got no disappointments today. Second hour, Jimmy Akin will be here. And we're going to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin. And maybe we'll get some weird answers out of Jimmy Akin. We will see how that goes. This hour, I think you are really going to enjoy. I wonder, have you ever thought about this? Was there a time when the Catholic faith was dying and artists saved it? That's kind of the premise of Liz Lev's book. She says, and I think you will be fascinated to hear the story, that amid the crisis of faith and sacraments and saints and confusion about Mary and the Mass and that came following the birth of Protestantism, a flood of art was produced by the Catholic Church that brought healing and restoration to Catholicism. Liz, as I said, Liz Lev is our guest. The book is How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in the Counter-Reformation. Liz Lev is an art historian. That's kind of underselling it when I say that. Best-selling author, international speaker, certified sommelier. That is one of my favorite things. She teaches Baroque, Renaissance, and Christian art at Duquesne University in Rome. Elizabeth Lev, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm here.
Hello.
No Liz yet? Okay. We'll give it a second. She's in Rome. See, that's it. Oh, I can see her, but I cannot hear her. She's joining us from Rome, the Eternal City. And we'll have that connection up in just a second.
Okay.
All right. We got her. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Oh, I can see her lips moving, but I can't hear that sound. Sometimes that happens when you're going internationally. We're about to go internationally to Australia. We were planning the shows this morning and actually gave up on some because sometimes it is very hard to make that connection internationally. If you're in Australia and you want to see us when Catholic Answers is coming, Carlo's going to come. Tim's going to come. I'll be there. Our president, Chris Check, will be there. And next, not the current weekend, but the weekend following, we will be in Sydney. And you can just Google Catholic Answers Sydney. We're going to be there with Perugia Media, and it's going to be I think hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe a couple thousand people coming. And then the following weekend, we will be in Perth. We'll be down with the folks from Evangelization Australia, also expecting hundreds and hundreds of people. Tim will be there. Carlo, me, and Chris won't be there because we're going to replace him for that conference with Dr. Stacey Drusenko. So that's an upgrade. And so if you are in Australia, I hope that you will join us there. Our number here, by the way, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. So if you would like, if you have questions about Catholic art, if you have questions about the premise that Catholic art saved the faith following the Reformation, during the Catholic Reformation, sometimes called the Counter-Reformation, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I will tell you this, if you got a tour, if you get a chance to tour a Vatican museum, or you want to see one of the churches of Rome where there's a great deal of art, or maybe examine some frescoes in Rome, there is no better person to be with than Liz Lev. Now, I do not know that personally because I ain't been there yet, but I'm heading out there soon. But from what everybody says, Liz Lev is absolutely your best tour, a tour guide for the art of the Eternal City. I believe we have a connection with her there in Rome now. Liz, you with us?
I am here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I'm sorry that we had a little technical trouble there. I hate to put you through that. But is it true that that maybe even more than arguments, maybe more than all the other efforts, and there were a great deal of efforts that the church made, the art of the Counter-Reformation saved the everyday faith of Catholics?
If you think of it, it goes all the way back to that famous phrase, a picture says a thousand words.
Yeah.
And where, especially when it comes to questions of doctrine and trying to drive home fundamental teachings of the faith, instead of explaining to people with treatises, which they're not going to read, or long explanations,
right,
the idea of being able to show a picture, to involve people, engage people in something beautiful and make them want to be part of it, was very, very powerful. So the church used images, something we've been using from the 3rd century AD. It used images to be able to transmit the faith, and so managed to preserve it, save it, help it, forward it, propagate
it. Especially when it comes to questions.
Again, 888-318-7884 is our number. Liz Lev is our guest. This work, you might say the church produced this art, but not all the people who produced this art would immediately strike us as paragons of the Catholic faith.
Absolutely not. The one that always leaps to the fore of this one, of course, is Caravaggio. Caravaggio, who is one of everyone's favorite painters. Once you've been to Rome, which I understand you have yet to do, once you've been to Rome and you've seen him, he's an artist who manages to captivate my students year after year after year. And he's a man whose life is known to us through prison records, a man who eventually kills a man in 1606. I mean, obviously not on paper, what you would say, here we go, this is how you follow the Catholic life. But the struggle between what he knew he must do and his inability to reach that ideal, which plays out in his use of light and dark, is captivating even today, 400 years later.
So these are works, for example, Caravaggio or any of the other great masters of the period. These are works that they are producing of their own volition? These are works that are someone is coming to them, a bishop or someone, and saying, paint us a Madonna and child, or paint us a martyr, or how is this happening?
Well, the way that the art is produced in this period is a patronage. So it's a collaboration between a religious order, a private person, a diocese, and an artist, in which these conversations, more or less intense, take place between the two of them. And at the end of the day, the idea of creating a work of art in tandem becomes something that's theologically sound, meaningful, but also at the same time allows this incredible expressive creativity on the part of the artist.
888-318-7884, the number you are listening to. The Friday edition of Catholic Answers Live, and we're talking with Elizabeth Lev, the author of How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. What's the deal with the word truth there? Like, it just doesn't seem like we connect to the word truth with art very much anymore.
Well, first of all, the idea, which I thank you for throwing me this lovely softball over the plate, beauty, truth, goodness are all transcendentals. They all go together. And the idea of that which is beautiful, that is also true and is also good. And your question is such a perfect one, because it really points out the breakdown that we have in our age, where we don't see beauty as a vehicle for good or truth. And as a matter of fact, as Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI used to say, he has said that we almost distrust beauty as we distrust truth, as if it's something that's not real. And so somehow the artificial prettiness that we like to follow, the immediate charming, as opposed to something that is resonant. The other thing that Pope Emeritus, actually when it was Cardinal Ratzinger, he wrote this, beauty has the capacity to wound, something truly beautiful. You know that phrase that we throw around, it's so beautiful it hurts?
Yes, right.
That concept of beauty that wounds us, that makes us vulnerable, that makes us receptive to new ideas, the possibility of changing, it opens up new horizons, which is a painful thing, this kind of huge fundamental transitional change. Beauty has that power. And you know, when you harness that power, as they did in the late 16th, early 17th century, to be able to create works that take your breath away and make you, at the end of the day, want to be a better person, that was a very heady and effective moment in the history of art.
I want to ask you about technology and science, because in part I'm curious about how much of the beauty that's achieved in the art of the Counter-Reformation period is because of technical advances and new understandings of things like perspective, but then also how much of this art is interested in the technological and scientific advances of the times?
Well, there are two parts to the answer to that question. One is very factual. One is a little idea I have. The very factual part is that one-point linear perspective, which opens the door to the Renaissance, so Michelangelo, Raphael, this is about 100 years earlier, is perfected during the late 1400s and the early 1500s. And so the capacity of making a three-dimensional space on a two-dimensional surface is fully achieved.
Yeah.
The Counter-Reformation, the Baroque, is going to take it to a whole new level, because instead of worrying about making that three-dimensional space horizontally so we can look at a window or a mirror to the world that we look at, if you notice, a great deal of the Baroque art is very interested in either opening up the heavens, so you start seeing this perspective functioning on the ceiling, or secondly, the perspective starts to engage you even more. So a great Counter-Reformation artist, the Carracci, Caravaggio, will leave a space in the painting where it appears that you're supposed to enter into that space.
Yeah.
So the space has gone more than being a mirror, but it's actually become a gateway into a world where you are expected to participate. So that the technological advances in perspective are hugely important. There is a second technological advance, which has to do with oil paint, because the previous types of painting, the most popular sorts of painting, i.e. fresco, which is a lime plaster tinged with a watercolor, which becomes colored stone. That's what the Sistine Chapel is done in. Or tempera, which is egg yolk mixed with pigment on a wood panel, are fast-drying, somewhat... they're slow technique. They're techniques that require a lot. They're techniques that require a lot of speed. So you have to know what you're doing. It doesn't allow for a lot of spontaneity. So oil painting, which is the tremendous development in the latter half of the 16th century, oil paint allows for immediacy, for spontaneity, and it also means anybody can oil paint. So one of the really exciting things that happens, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that women can start painting, because oil painting opens up a door for women to paint. So that is the kind of aspect of the technological breakthrough that's important for the production of art. But I think something very important happened in that period that was scientific, that really is the game changer. And it's when Galileo shows up selling these telescopes that he has perfected so that people can look through a little instrument and see something the human eye has never seen before, whether it be the moons around Jupiter or the marks on the moon. It allows the enhancement of the human eye to a point where we begin to think, wow, what if our human eye were enhanced to the point where we could see that which the saints see. So the other thing the Counter-Reformation does in the wake of these new developments is we work on helping people see that which the human eye is limited in seeing, whether it's your guardian angel, the ecstatic visions of Saint Teresa. That's another very important reflection on a major scientific breakthrough of the age.
That is how fascinating, because you do see that. You see, you're looking at things in many of these paintings that, while there, are not visible to the eye, and they're making that visible. I had never even considered that connection before. I do want you to make the connection for us with how we see in the art of the Counter-Reformation period the church responding to the kind of the coming discoveries, the age of discovery getting going and all of that. Because on the one hand, it's clear that this art in its richness is responding to the kind of simplified religion of the Protestant Reformation, the simplified in every virtually every respect. And then it's trying to present a rich view. But we also get the story of the church now having to confront a new, and I'll put this in quotes, enemy in science and that kind of thing. So I would like you to, because you do this at the end of the book a bit, and I was very interested to see it. What does the painting of this period tell us about the church's response to this burgeoning age of discovery. However, we have to take a quick break, so I'll let you ponder for a moment. We will come right back with Elizabeth Lev, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, right after this.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Vatican officials will meet to decide the fate of disgraced former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick.
Pro-life leaders applauding the president's strong stand for life.
A new poll finds most Americans, including those identifying as pro-choice, are opposed to late-term abortion.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
News headlines you can have faith in. Weekdays at the top of the hour on EWTN Radio.
We're talking with Elizabeth Lev about her very well-received book from Sophia Institute Press, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. Assistant producer Marie has been reading it in recent weeks, and she's kind of fangirling out right now that Liz is on with us. One of the things about I'll get to that in a minute, actually. I want to go back to the question I asked you before about the age of discovery and does this art kind of glorify the church over science? Does it perceive that there is a conflict between church and science? What do we see in the art of this period?
I wouldn't say that the church perceives any conflict between church and science at the time, because the scientists are usually churchmen. But the problem is, and this is where we're sort of heading into two different directions here, but the problem is the speed with which science and discovery and conclusions are being made don't necessarily take into account how to move the faithful along in these huge leaps. So this wonderful painting, and I think really a big part of writing the book was a chance to bring this artist out who is virtually unknown. His name is Niccolo Tornioli, and he was employed by the family who was very, very close to both Galileo and Pope Urban VIII. And if you remember, the trial of Galileo was instigated by
they were
Urban
frenemies.
VIII after Galileo. They were They're a perfect case of frenemies. And so the Spada family, as it were, they are the ones who commission a painting to describe what happens. And so you have this amazing slash. It's just a diagonal through the painting where one half has a science that's based on theory and based on tradition and based on received understanding versus the science that's based on experience. And since today we really completely believe in science based on experience, we look at this and think, well, why were they even bothering looking at what people thought before, and why do they care about with this received knowledge? And that's really where the overtaking of one to the other takes place. But really, the church doesn't respond with, oh my gosh, bad science. Think about how the church responds to the discovery of the new world. I mean, this isn't even a Counter-Reformation question, but shortly after the discovery of the new world, in the Sistine Chapel itself, Julius II heard a sermon. So we're talking 1512. This is, you know, the Reformation hasn't happened yet. 1512, the sermon asks the question, how are we to evangelize a people we didn't know existed 10 years ago? It's not a, oh my gosh, there's no new world. Please tell us there's no new world. We can't deal with this. It's a, we have a new field for evangelization. How are we going to go out there? What a
what an exciting and beautiful thing. I find that a very, very lovely part of the church, that it handled it with a sense of, let's go find a way to do this. And of course, the great flowering of these missions, the Jesuits and all of their glory, the Francis Xaviers, they come during the Counter-Reformation period. So the images of Africa, Asia, America, Europe become part of the art, trying to represent, look at this new world that we haven't seen, we probably will never see, but know that it's there.
Liz Lev is our guest. The book is How Catholic Art Saved the Faith. Our number 888-318-7884. Up first is Anna in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on the Amazon Echo. Anna, your question for Elizabeth Lev.
Hi, Liz.
Hey.
I've always been a fan of this period, and I was recently gifted your book, so I'm very excited to keep reading it. But specifically, I was wondering, Artemisia Gentileschi is an artist that I've always kind of been interested in, and given her unique status as a female artist during this time, I was just curious if you think her work might have provided a different insight or take on biblical art and Catholic art. And if so, how that might have been used by the church for a specific message, or maybe engaged onlookers in a different way?
Well, that is a great question, and it mentions a great artist who is Artemisia Gentileschi. She is the daughter of Orazio Gentileschi, who was a close personal friend of Caravaggio. And Artemisia's life in sort of, if you will, mainstream art history is pretty much colored by the fact that she was subjected to a rape trial at the age of 17. She was seduced slash raped by Agostino Tassi, a collaborator of her father, and underwent a very sort of horrific trial in which obviously the way she was tried was through the character of the accuser. And so art history has often seen her paintings, which tend to be very graphic due to her being influenced by Caravaggio, images of things like the beheading of Holofernes and the beheading of John the Baptist, these sort of very violent images, as a kind of rebellion against a patriarchal church, a hatred of men, yada, yada, yada. What this overlooks is that the number of paintings she did of Mary Magdalene is only too short of the number of the so-called beheading paintings she did. And so Artemisia Gentileschi is a very interesting character, because instead of being dropped by the Counter-Reformation Society that allegedly, you know, only accepted perfect people, as people like to think when they talk about the Counter-Reformation, Artemisia became an extremely popular painter, particularly for these images that seem to be good warring against evil, virtue warring against vice. So she takes the age-old story of Judith and Holofernes, the beautiful Jewish widow who defeats the Assyrian general by playing his vices against himself, and she really turns it into something very graphic and powerful. And I find, and I really do believe this when I was working on the book, that she is a figure that really helps us understand that sometimes to conquer vices, our vices, sometimes to conquer the evil, the darkness, the desire for wrong things within us, it has to get messy and it has to get gritty. Not everybody gets to stay clean and pleasantly scented without a hair out of place as they combat sin. And certainly she knew this. And so her very graphic and powerful images from a woman let us know that, you know, there is the possibility we have within ourselves that heroic power to combat, to put down, to cut off sin.
Anna?
Yes. How's that? Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for bringing that wonderful artist to our attention. Again, our number 888-318-7884. Elizabeth Lev is our guest. She has stayed up into the middle of the night in Rome to be on with us. How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. It's available now from the Sophia Institute Press. You are a great storyteller. I think that's one of your great gifts. It doesn't read like a textbook. It's not dry at all. But if I look at a painting, say, I mean, I guess go back to Caravaggio or whatnot, and this question kind of, Marie asked me to ask you this, you're a fangirl. How do you find the story, if you're an untrained person, how do you find the story in a work of art? How do you look at that work of art and know what it is that the artist is saying there?
Well, it's several different things. One is just start with the story. I mean, really, when I studied art history, you know, one of the first things I had to do, the first book you buy, Subjects and Symbols in Art. I mean, my copy, which has got to be back here somewhere, is from 1980-something. And
when you were a baby.
When I was a newborn and they put it in my cradle, it's one of the very first things you get. And then, you know, eventually I realized the Subjects and Symbols in Art isn't really enough. So I bought the Bible to follow up. Then you buy things like the Golden Legend, which tells the way that we've passed down the stories of our saints.
Liz, I'm really sorry. Oh. Can we finish on the other side? I apologize.
Absolutely.
We're right up against the break. Liz Lev is our guest. The book is How Catholic Art Saved the Faith. Your questions at 888-318-7884 are more than welcome. 888-318-7884.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred Scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries, Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Are you haunted by a loved one's suicide?
Let's navigate this grief together on Monday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now, let's get back to more of Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Art Saved the Faith. That's Elizabeth Lev's book from Sophia Institute Press, and we are discussing it right now. 888-318-7884 is the number if you'd like to get in on the conversation. 888-318-7884. I have to say, if one word comes to mind looking at the art in the book, and Sophia makes such beautiful books, I'm glad you went with them because the reproductions in the book are beautiful. But if you had to pick a word for this art, it is very, I would say, sensuous. And it's extremely vibrant. It just feels like you're, as you said before, you're in it. There's a lot of naked shoulders in here and arms and legs. And I wonder if it in addition to saving the faith, also was shocking at all in its time.
So first of all, I just want to say thank you to Sophia for going with me. In all honesty, it was
really?
Sophia that came and asked me. Yes, Sophia is the one who said, "You've been reading these articles. Would you like to turn it into a book?" So I think that's how this whole thing came about. Before we go any further, So thank you to Sophia for coming to me with the idea of making a book and then doing such a beautiful job with it. I mean, really, every time I pick it up, everyone says, oh, it's so heavy.
Well, it's because it's got those glossy pages in it.
Yes, it's got those wonderful glossy pages. So that's very, I'm very grateful for that. Since I'm sitting here wearing my tank top I think it's the first few days of October, but you know, Rome, it's warm. So bare shoulders is kind of a thing around here because it was 80 degrees today in Rome. Sorry guys, if that makes you unhappy. So, but really to get to your real point, sensuousness is, this is in a moment in art where the church and artists try to find, it's almost like a last desperate attempt to find a harmony between the created world, the beauty of creation, the beauty of the things of this world, whether it's the human flesh, whether it's food or color or silk or velvet, And the spiritual. And they're trying to harmonize the two. They're trying, instead of having to sort of, Byzantine art sort of favors the spiritual world over the natural world. The Renaissance perhaps in some ways favored the natural world over the spiritual world. The Counter-Reformation leading into the Baroque tries to find some kind of balance between the two, and understanding that part of what is attractive and that what is beautiful is sensuousness. The fact that we are given senses, and why, as my husband always asks, as a sommelier, he always asks, why do we have taste buds? Like, what's the point? If we're just supposed to eat to nourish ourselves, why do we crave things that aren't good for us? And so this idea that we are really meant to also be able to sense, understand, experience beauty, experience the pleasures of this world, but also begin to understand how they relate to the greater elements of the spiritual world.
Again, Liz Lev, our guest, our number 888-31 Truth. Do you, when you write a book for, put a book together like this, there must be marks that every culture has on what it's able to appreciate. And I wonder if the average Italian or Frenchman or Spaniard of the Counter-Reformation period was actually better able to appreciate this art than we are now. Do you have that sense? And maybe that's part of why you wrote the book, is to wake us up to it a little bit.
I think part of what people were able to discuss more easily were questions of biblical stories, the meaning of biblical stories, and concordance in biblical stories. I mean, this is one of those things where one of my pet subjects, so we're probably going to end up going to your break again, but the idea that I hear every single day in the Vatican Museum, and I hear it a great deal. People sort of look at all the pictures. Oh, these are very nice pictures. Oh, they must have cost a fortune. And someone says, well, of course, they were illiterate and they needed pictures to be able to read. And you know, my thought, and occasionally it actually slips out from my lips, is, if the only thing you've read in the past 4 years is 50 Shades of Grey and you think you're literate, you might be a little off the mark there. So people can be quite, capable of reading to a certain extent. But if you don't read anything that nourishes you, helps you, enriches you, then you are basically the same as an illiterate. When Gregory the Great is the one who said that the Bible is, instead of reading Pope St. Gregory the Great and a letter in like 600, he was talking about, he says, especially to the Gentiles, who were people who read a great deal, but they didn't know anything about how the story of the sacrifice of Isaac is actually a precursor for the sacrifice of Christ, how the image of Jonah is Jesus's death and resurrection. And we are in the exact same position today, where most people don't understand that a story of the Old Testament, a story of Christ, has a resonance, a meaning, a connection. Most don't understand that, but people really knew that, and they knew their saints. I mean, today, well, I guess it's already Saturday, but yesterday was Saint Francis, the feast day of Saint Francis. I mean, the entire cities partied all day long to celebrate Saint Francis with productions and events, and each one of these feast days, whether it's the Ascension, whether it's the Assumption, whether it's Francis, whether it's Saint Petronius in Bologna. People knew their saints, they knew their stories, they knew images connected to them. And we are, very far removed from that today. So I do think most people had the tools to begin to understand the art of the age, kind of like most people, insofar as breaking down the images, have the ability to understand the movies we see today. So today people are very good at movies, right? So every single chestnut in Infinity War that leads to Endgame and the Avengers series, people can read all that. They understand that.
Right.
But people used to not give that attention to the Avengers. They gave that attention to their biblical art.
So if we're saying that that this art saved the faith, then the people were immersed, as you're saying, in a world in which the Bible was real, the saints were real, they knew these people in a way that for us maybe like a Thor is real or Captain America. These are the people who occupy our cultural world. But maybe if we could just take the sacraments, because clearly one way of reading Protestantism is it's an attack on the sacraments, the disconnection of Christianity from the Eucharist and the other sacraments, except excluding baptism, but even baptism gets put aside at in some ways. How does this art save the sacraments? How does this art save a kind of a sacramental Christianity from a desacramentalizing Christianity?
That's the crux of everything. As a matter of fact, the first section of the book is really about sacraments, because at the end of the day, that's the thing that matters. So Martin Luther basically takes, or the Protestants take the sacraments from 7, then they take them down to 5, then they take them down to 2. I mean, the sacraments just, they diminish. And even the nature of what baptism is for changes mind of the Protestant Reformation. But as you correctly say, the most serious problems are the sacraments of both reconciliation or penance and the sacraments of the Eucharist. Art really rallies around the Eucharist. And so that first and foremost, the rebuilding of churches, the way churches are built from the latter half of the 16th century on, is to create a greater connection between the faithful and the Eucharist. So you put a tabernacle on the altar. Simultaneously, you remove the rood screen, which is the screen that used to be in the middle of the church to prevent the faithful from seeing consecration. So now there's a clear visual. Then you have the construction of churches that are built to really focus, like a telescope, your eye towards the altar. And then you have, conveniently, at the exact same time, you have people like Philip Neri who are introducing adoration of the Blessed Sacrament into literally the world. So you have buildings that are set up for adoration. You have this idea of adoration and being in the presence of Christ in the sacrament. And then you have paintings that really start to show you the body of Christ being delivered to the altar. And these artists, whether they're Caravaggio or Barocci, who is one of my favorites, or Domenichino and the Last Communion of St. Jerome, these images where the centrality of the Eucharist really becomes, paramount.
So I suppose then, is that hard when you're, is there a conflict there then in maybe when you're giving a tour and there's a Protestant person taking a tour and seeing these paintings, that they don't practice the kind of Christianity that's being depicted there? Do you see that? Does it have an effect, or does it just not resonate?
I find it actually interestingly. I had a week like that last week, and where I was taking several people who were Protestants around, and I don't really change much when I talk about. I mean, it is what it is, right? And I can pretend it's something else, but I do that. And so the painting is the image of the entombment of Caravaggio is Jesus's body being dropped on the altar, and the little slab of stone that comes out with the space underneath it is really meant for the priest to be standing underneath it, so that you have the body of Christ, which is being brought to the altar as the priest is celebrating the Mass. So there's no point in kind of pretending that's not what we're looking at. And so I find that it leads to very interesting conversations. It leads to it's art, so it's not a confrontational thing. It's not a so and therefore your religion is all wrong. That's not what it is, but it allows us to kind of talk about things, talk through ideas of, you believe this, why do you believe this, how do you get around this, explaining how people feel distant from the sacrament because of a series of things that happen, even if something as simple as a question about pews in churches, right? People always ask me, we walk into Santa Maria Maggiore, it's a big open space. Well, where are your pews? Well, pews are a Protestant invention because the idea of what we do in a church is fundamentally different. In a Protestant church, we make God present through the word, right? So we listen to the sermon, we bring out God through the scripture. In the Catholic Mass, we bring God present on the altar. He's there. And so we're all processing toward. We're not still, the reason for this, the long basilica is we're going towards it. We're trying to get, God is over there. Come on, get moving.
Yeah. I'm glad that you're able to have those conversations. I do want to, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask about another couple things that the Reformation in its stripping down of Christianity to a kind of basic form of Christianity that get kind of pushed aside are purgatory, clearly, and that's and Mary herself. So I want to ask you about the artists who kind of defend or recover purgatory and Mary when we come back. Liz Lev is our guest. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884 if you'd like to get in on the conversation. Of course, Protestant folks are welcome anybody's welcome to ask their question. 888-318-7884. The book again, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, Elizabeth Kelly from Sophia Institute Press. Right back after this.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
I had to go through fear and thank God that I overcame the fear and I just left it up to God. And now there's no more fear. There's just acceptance. And I'm just learning to listen. If you want to be closer to God, you just need to keep following His rules. And your application, your radio station has helped me to always be positive and continue to listen to the rules and obey.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. How Catholic Art Saved the Faith is the book by Elizabeth Kelly, our guest this hour. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. So I'm just running through with you some of the aspects of the faith that this art was able to either recover or just make sure that people maintain their connection to it, I guess. So what about purgatory? This is really, in many ways, what the Reformation is about, is this idea that there can be indulgences. I mean, I think in the theses that were posted by Luther, more than half of them are about indulgences and purgatory. How did the artists assist in maintaining this Catholic teaching about purgatory, this reality of purgatory?
I think purgatory was a kind of a tricky play on the part of the Protestant Reformation. And while one can understand, especially with abuses regarding indulgences, one can understand Martin Luther's perspective, the fundamental idea of that there is a connection between our church that is militant on earth and the church of the people who have died, and this connection of the people who are in heaven, hoping to get to heaven, that there's a possibility to kind of perfect ourselves for heaven, to take that away is a very brutal, it's a very brutal rift between people and their understanding of how they are to progress towards heaven, this journey, this pilgrimage. And we really do have, we are a pilgrim church on earth, do we not call it? And so the church really, one of the things that artists excel at is that they can show us things that we cannot see. And so bringing to bear the mind of an artist to be able to show us the joy of a soul released from purgatory. I mean, the last time someone had done that effectively was when Dante in 1300 published the Divine Comedy. And my goodness, the images of purgatory that he left us, they resonate to this day. And so Dante took us on a voyage to see the three places we, as living mortal beings, we can't see. As a writer, as a poet, he brought us to this extraordinary space. And then painters try to continue that work of Dante to help us see that there are souls who need our prayers and that we need theirs.
So is there an image that I guess the image you were just describing, I was going to say that an image that strikes you most about purgatory. So, but the thing that they're doing is showing us that connection between this life and, or I guess our efforts here in this life and those who are in the next stages of the Christian life, purgation and paradise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. What about Mary? Here's the deal we get. People who, Protestants who became Catholic, they tell us all the time, the biggest problem was Mary. I just couldn't get my, I couldn't go with you Catholics on Mary. I was so nervous about you Catholics and the worship of Mary. And sometimes it kind of does look like we're worshiping Mary in some of these paintings. What do these artists make of Mary, and what are they trying to accomplish in their paintings of Mary?
I think one of the greatest pieces of insight I had was when I was reading and researching for this book, beginning to realize, and this was actually laid out by several authors, that there's just a fundamental difference in how Mary's role works over time. And that the Protestants, of course, have no disrespect. They don't disrespect Mary per se. She's in the Bible. She existed. The virgin birth, the Annunciation, she's the mother of God. No argument there. But the vision they have of Mary is that Mary was, you know, Jesus's mom. So she's like Mrs. J. She made nice cookies. She, you know, made Jesus, and then she just kind of retires to a back role.
Okay.
So her role is that of bearing God, and she does the thing, and then, okay, well, that's nice, and yeah, you're great, Mom. And then when she dies, it's like, yeah, he had a great mom, but she doesn't continue to be active. The Catholics believe that Mary, because of this exceptional thing she did, this fiat, this submission, this obedience, this active obedience. Plus, it's not a submissive, like, oh, okay, I just don't care, so you can do whatever you want. It's an active choice on Mary's part,
yeah,
to continue to say yes to God from the minute she's told, when she's 15 years old, she's going to have a baby and she's going to explain this thing to Joseph, all the way up to her son being arrested, tortured, and killed. This is a very active thing she does. And that activeness of Mary's trust and belief in God gives her the possibility to be active for all time. And that's an amazing role for a woman to carry. So in many ways, it seems to me that the Catholic Church had hardwired into it, thanks to its vision of Mary's continuous active role that transforms over time, it also allows women to have a sense of a role that they can fulfill in complementarity with Jesus, and allows us to kind of a greater sort of what John Paul II, St. John Paul II, called feminine genius. It's experienced in many different ways, but to the point, the Catholics will therefore try to represent this specialness of Mary, especially through the images of the Assumption, images of the Immaculate Conception, but also the images of her constant intercession.
And does it work? I mean, like, do people get it? I mean, I guess that's what I want to know, is on what level does the artwork, does it get kind of seep into the society so that this is a new image of womanhood, or this is a different image of the Pilgrim Church, and these things become just part of the shared faith life of the people? Is that your sense of it, or how do you see it kind of having its effects?
I feel like people crave it.
Okay.
I feel like people craved, in that particular period, they craved images of Mary, the way that we craved, for a movie to come out about a book we really liked. We want to see it. We want to sit there in the theater and cheer for it. We want to experience it with more than just the senses of reading and trying to make our imagination work. We want to stand in front of it and feel like, yeah, you know, and so the question of the Immaculate Conception becomes particularly heated, particularly important, and particularly insisted on, not by the church, but by the lay people who are like, we need you to be clear about this teaching about Mary, because we know, they know she's here for us. They can feel it, but they want the church to step up and give us that, you know, this is the Mary that we know. We're not worshiping her, but we know she's this amazing, wonderful figure. Give us an image to rally around. And so I think it's not really just a, oh, okay, give us some pictures so that we can teach this. She's my favorite, the Avenger. I want a giant poster of her, you know?
Up next, David in Omaha, Nebraska, listening. Go ahead. Sorry, Liz. Go ahead.
It all goes back to the Avengers.
I'm happy that it does. Believe me. David in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. David, your question for Liz Lev.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering, I've been a metal sculptor for 23 years. The majority of what I make is usually focused on the crucifixion, the thing that I was drawn to from funnel, the first thing I remember drawing, and I was raised with no faith whatsoever. And so through my journey of becoming Catholic and finally now being able to make three-dimensional, beautiful crucifixes, I'm wondering, what is your opinion in regards to evangelization, not only of non-Catholics but of fallen away Catholics? In your opinion, what would be the best, or which direction do you see art playing a role in evangelization today?
Oh, that's a very clear question. All right. Help an artist out.
I think art needs to be what we were talking about earlier. It needs to be beautiful, true, and good. Let's just start with the fact that anybody saying that art does not have a role in evangelization obviously has not seen the line outside the Vatican Museums. The Vatican Museums has 30,000 people a day standing outside waiting to get in to be crushed to death to go look at a room, which, whether or not they're going to understand the ins and outs and every little detail of it, they stand there and they want to feel something. They want to experience something. And so you look at people looking up expectantly at that ceiling. Now, whether everybody gets it when they walk away, who knows? But there's something that happens for them to be in that space and to see that kind of beauty. So I think art plays a huge role. And if you are drawn to the crucifixion and that's what speaks to you and it helps you understand, it brought you from a place of no faith to faith, then that's what you should be sharing. We are, at the end of the day, it is a faith of witness. I met Jesus this way. I know Jesus this way. Jesus and I have a relationship this way. Can I introduce you to my friend Jesus, my really good friend who died on the cross for us? I mean, it's that kind of persuasion. When that's for me personally, Michelangelo's utter conviction. When I began to realize that Michelangelo's utter conviction that this is true, when I realized he thought it was true. At the end of the day, Michelangelo was probably my best friend, which I know is weird. Most of my friends died about 400 or 500 years ago, but we'll leave it aside.
That is weird.
If he believes it, why shouldn't I? And so really, that witness that art can make, and through the artist who lets you know this is the greatest thing I've ever seen, that I've ever met, the most beautiful thing I've ever known. Can I show it to you? That's how you do it.
What do you make of that, David?
I think that's spot on. And, you know, I think there's a reason I sold almost more crucifixes to Protestants than to Catholics. And it all comes down for me to John 12, 32 and 33, where Jesus said he would draw all men unto himself through his being lifted up from this earth, the way in which he would die. And that's what I inscribe on every crucifix I make, because Jesus drew me to him through his crucifixion before I was Catholic, before I knew who God was. And I so appreciate your words. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
David, you should get the book, How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. It's from Sophia Institute Press. Its author has been our esteemed guest, and we really do have a great deal of esteem for Liz Lev. Elizabeth Lev, thank you so much for staying up in the middle of the Roman night and spending the time with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next, Jimmy Akin will be here. We're going to finish off the week with Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Books, ideas, paintings that have been mentioned this hour, you can always go to the show page, and you can see the show notes there. Nick puts them there. But I'll say the name of the book one more time because I really want you to get it. How Catholic Art Saved the Faith, The Triumph of Beauty and Truth in Counter-Reformation Art. Get it from Sophia Institute Press before they run out.